This creates a deviation in the breath. So each time we experience a trauma that's too much for us, we use our breath. And as Buddha would say, in this time, the breath and our emotions are inseparable.
Welcome to Take a Deep Breath. Today's Breathcast guest is a shamanic healer, practitioner, breathwork instructor who uses the dark. His name is Greg and he runs sacredtree.co. Link is in the description below. And I connected to Greg through a mutual friend and I had a lovely good hour and I think 15, 20 minutes with Greg. And again, one of those people, if you've seen previous podcast with the lady with the Holotropic Institute, Diana, he's one of these people that just has a really great healing energy and you can just talk to these people for hours. Greg does all sorts of different things with the breath. The thing that I found most terrifying and intriguing and interesting is the ceremonies he does where people are in the dark for days doing breath work and rebirth. So I think you'll get a lot from this breathcast. We definitely delve more into the spiritual side in this one, which I really enjoy to do. Again, Greg is a fountain of knowledge. He's got a really great backstory. So you can learn what shamanism is, these breathwork modalities that he does, how he keeps a safe space for people and how he gets people to release emotions and stored things. We talk a lot about shame as well, which is quite interesting. It's a difference between shame and guilt. So I really hope you enjoy this breathcast. Couple of quick messages before we get stuck in. Number one, takeadeepbreath.co.uk is our Instagram handle and we are rebuilding the content on there now. There's lots of clips on there, some really cool posts. So please, if you haven't done so already, descriptions, links, all that good stuff, go over to Instagram. Please follow us. It would be great if you could do that. We've got a few followers on there now, so it's getting quite exciting. If you're new to this channel, we have over 100 videos dedicated to breathing and breath work. So after this breathcast, get stuck in and fill your boots with some of these different breathing exercises that we've got and leave some comments below. Let us know how you found them. And then I guess the last thing for me is if you are listening to this, if you could leave us a review, that would be very appreciated. So if you could leave us an iTunes review or wherever you get your podcasts, that would be great. Anyway, enough yapping from this. Let's get stuck into the breathcast. Cheers. Okay, and we are recording. Greg, how are you doing today, sir?
I'm doing really well, thank you. Yes, all the better for being able to relax and talk about the things I love with you.
Yeah, no, really excited. I'm so glad we managed to hook this up as well, because I know we're both super busy people and we had a couple of times where we had this booked in. So it's so wonderful to get some time now and we can have a good old chat about breath work and a load of other things, I'm sure.
Indeed, yes. I'm looking forward to it too. Yeah,
great. So can I just start off by asking, I always cringe when I ask this question because it's such a big question, but can you just tell us a bit about who you are and what you do?
Okay, so yeah, that's an interesting question. I am a collection of experiences, like experiencing myself in this world and trying to defrag a childhood full of different experiences. That's who I am. Mm-hmm. And I've been very blessed to have had all of the pain and suffering that I've had in my life and to have been guided by the right people through my life into the path that I'm on now, which is one of sharing healing in different ways with people through various different techniques. I currently work as a facilitator of shamanic practices, all sorts of different shamanic practices. The one we're going to talk about here is the breath, but I work with darkness, with breath, and I work with energy healing and shamanic healing and all sorts of different holistic therapies work together, from physical, emotional, social, spiritual, all mingled in one together to help people find their purpose and to become better versions of themselves.
Oh, wow. There's a lot going on there. That's really exciting to pick into. Can you just clear one thing up for me? Because I've never known the answer to this. What does shamanic mean?
Shamanism. So shamanism has different aspects to it. For many, it's to draw upon the energies of things outside ourselves in, we would call these the spirits in different forms, in order to help with a healing practice. And in order to connect and create allies of them, we enter into different states of mind, breath being the perfect one of them. And it can be in various different ways, through sound, through movement, through breath, are the three main tools of a shaman to be able to connect with something beyond. And the spirit realm, it's an interesting thing. Some people feel like it's the imagination, that there's something out that we can, outside that we can speak to. And really, in this duality world, actually all of the archetypes that are within us, we can reach outside of ourselves. Mm-hmm. So I also work with shadow work. And this is the idea that everything is a mirror. So when we use life and our surroundings as our medium for connection, then in some way we're always projecting ourselves. So I could reach outside for the spirit of the lion, for instance, and I relate to the lion, and I might have that spirit within me and might be able to reach upon it, because there are those aspects of me that are within me. So you can use it in a psychological or a shamanic, in a spiritual way. They're two different languages that mean basically the same thing. So shamanism is drawing upon these powers, really, in order to help with healing and guidance and all of life's treasures.
Wow. And how the heck did you get involved in all of this? I'm really interested. I don't know actually what your backstory is. So can you talk me through where you kind of started with all of this?
It was an interesting thing. I think the first time I started reaching outside was when a friend of mine had discovered that she had HIV and she wasn't looking after herself. And always in life, I've always aimed to help people. It's always been part of what I do, partly maybe because actually I want helping somehow. And I think there's that aspect of it. But so I started looking into nutrition, different ways she could help herself, and started doing her research for her so I could try and help her. And that opened up a whole box of things about nutrition. And I was all in to begin with, to do with the body, how we can heal anything through diet is possible, and or heal any problems through our mind and our willpower and creating our imagination and controlling. And it really began that way. And so I was learning a lot about like NLP, lots of different sides of this thing. And then I realized that you could heal, or you could create your reality with it, but unless you healed what was behind it and underneath it, then really you couldn't, it wasn't permanent. It wasn't an easy step to take. It took a lot of maintenance. And whereas if there was healing, if it was able to go to the root of what it was, then it's a lot easier. It's like becomes more of an acceptance, less about becoming what I thought I wanted to be or should be, coming from a place of shame of not being happy with myself as I am, but discovering who I am in order to become what actually would really make me most happy and what my purpose is on this planet. So after trying to help other people, I learned a lot about myself, and I started working with some of the physical things, with yoga, teaching yoga, with lots of different movements, with dance and movement in that way, and then started getting interested in other practices. And in this shamanic realm, doing all sorts of different things, working with plant medicines as well as non-psychoactive methods of shamanism, journeying, traveling, breath, and actually falling in love with the breath when I found this, which was such an easy way to go so deep and confront some of the most hidden and vulnerable parts of myself. It became such a simple practice, such a simple, beautiful practice in this way. I've just woven in every opportunity. Whenever I've found a dead end for myself, I found a new practice to fill that hole, and I've just been bringing in lots of different practices bit by bit. that have helped me and share them with other people as well.
I love that. Yeah. And tell me if this is too simplistic, but so are you saying that some of these things like NLP, they just don't address the root cause, that it's like a bit of a bandage and it will get you so far, but you've got to go deeper. Is that kind of what you're saying with some of the work that you do?
For me, I fell down the trap with a lot of self-help stuff. Affirmations is a good example of this, the idea of repeating something over and over again in order to make it reality for yourself. But there's so much you can repeat or work with in this way that will, it might create a reality for you, but that reality that you are creating for yourself might be becoming the person who somebody else thinks you want to be. Like, my mum would love me to be normal, an accountant and a normal job and have 2.4 children, and that can't help but affect me, in different ways. And lots of us, we have different pressures on us by society and by our parents and different things. But actually, somewhere deeper underneath that, all of those conflicting, dissonant voices pulling in either direction, by understanding where those voices come from, I can hear my own voice underneath it. And so NLP is a tool which is best used once you've come to an acceptance and understanding of who you are in the first place. And I think this is what a lot of these self-help courses, they teach you how to use these tools and hack your brain and hack your body. And as a hacker, you can really muck things up. You can make things worse. And that was the path I went down.
That's interesting. You just reminded me of a quote, and I'm probably going to butcher it now, but it's something like, I'm not who I think I am. I'm not who you think I am. I'm who I think you think I am. Have you ever heard that before? So it's like, so you go back to the mum analogy. I'm thinking, who does my mum think I am? And I end up trying to be that person, even though she's not telling me, I'm thinking what she's thinking. I'm trying to think what she thinks of me or whoever that person is. And then you can get a bit messed up then, because you're trying to be that person that you think that you want to be for each other. And then you're right, there's that voice underneath, and it's so easy to quiet that voice down or to ignore that voice. And I think in society today, we've got so good or so bad at shutting our internal voice down, haven't we, that we don't even listen to it that much these days, and we're constantly being distracted by technology and other ways of things.
The most common lie that we tell ourselves that is a result of the society having to form as the way it is the I'm not good enough. Even just being in the school system, comparing ourselves, examinations, the aim of them is to see how good you are. And because you're given a grade and some people are better than others, it's built into the way we are. And so we're constantly working out who we are according to these things that have been marked out for us as our guides of, IQ is one type of intelligence, but it's always seen as the one that we look for, intelligence quotient. But there's emotional intelligence. There's all sorts of intelligence that we can have. And exactly that. So often we are trapped in by our shame, actually, this idea. And shame is different from guilt. Guilt is I've done something wrong. Shame is I am wrong. And this idea that we, in order to be lovable, when we create an inventory of lovability when we're young, if I do this, I will be loved. If I do this, I won't be loved. Mm-hmm. So I mustn't do this. I hide into shadow this aspect of myself. This is the shadow work. The part, the bits that we hide, repress, or deny about ourselves that we're unable to love, or we think other people are unable to love, so we hide them. And actually, this can create who we think we're going to be. So this forms a big part of what I do as well, working with this shadow and working to be able to get to the point where I feel like I can be me without compromise, and there's no love that will be lost anywhere I go. Would be a perfect state of mind. Or natural antidote to this deep shame that's in there could be summed up in the sentence, if I could choose to be anybody on this planet, I would choose to be me. is the antidote. And it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, it is. Wow. So how do you get there then? I know that's, again, another big question. So talk to me. Can you talk to me a bit about how the breath work joins this and what you're doing with the breath?
Yeah. So I see these the breath work that I do is got a funny name. It's called rebirthing. And it was called rebirthing because originally when Leonard Orr discovered it, he really thought it was to do with the birth process, because the first really deep process that he had in his understanding, experiencing of it, was experiencing his own birth. And he was doing it in the bath with a snorkel and doing this breath work underneath. Because the bath is warm water and breathing through a tube is a little bit like this, then it mimics the womb. And his deepest trauma that was trapped inside was his birth. So he called it this, but really it's a conscious, connected breath work, which helps to cleanse. He actually met with one of the yogis who told him that this was an ancient Kriya Yoga technique, which is thousands of years old, that had been lost and rediscovered in this way. And so Kriya means to cleanse, really. It's a cleansing yoga. And so what it is that we, in order to survive, when we experience trauma in life, we have to be able to bypass it somehow if it's too much for us to deal with at the time. We have to go on, we have to survive. And so like little bubbles or pockets, we hold these things inside. Deep inside, and lots of different things are traumatic for us, and we've forgotten them completely. The mind is amazing. The energetics of the body, not just the mind, but the emotions and all of these things. Our being is amazing at just kind of squirreling them away to be ready for when we're ready to deal with them. In the same way as when you fast, lots of this stored toxicity in the fats comes to the surface and comes out. Because what the signal is to the body is that by resting our digestive system, 80% of the energy is gone and we're well enough to start to begin to throw out what's been stored. In the same way as when we create the right environment, all of these pockets of unexpressed emotions, unresolved traumas, actually, really, this is what trauma is. It's something that was too much for us at the time. And so we had to put it away. And this creates a deviation in the breath. So each time we experience a trauma that's too much for us, we use our breath. And as Buddha would say in this time, the breath and our emotions are inseparable. You can't go through anger or sadness or grief or shame, any of the strong emotions, without your breath changing. And if you want to change your emotions, you can change your breath. And people know this about it. You know, in order to relax, you can literally change the speed of the waves in your brain by changing your breath. The two are interlinked, they're inseparable. And so when we create this, when we experience trauma, we create deviations in our breath. And our breath contains and holds a map of all of the traumas that we've ever had. There's a simplistic way of looking at the breath in the rebirthing technique, which I can describe, which is that the in-breath is our embrace. It's how much we trust, how much we're leaning into and stepping into without fear. We're born without fear. We're born without all of these inhibitions. But life trains us in this way. So the breath, if we're able to breathe in, like smelling the rose of life, this flower with, it's like there's nothing that can harm us here because it's a rose. We're taking in this beautiful scent of life. However, if we've just been around a sewage leak somewhere, then we may not want to go so much. Because that something there is doesn't feel like it's right to take in. And so the breath in can be really affected by how much we trust to lean into life. And the breath out, in a moment, everything switches off. Everything lands. And there isn't a moment of resistance to anything that is. To all that is a total acceptance in a moment, a settling in. From a spiritual point of view, I would say falling into the arms of the divine, that we know the earth below us will always be there to support us because she always has been. Underneath us, the floor has never disappeared. The earth is underneath us all the time. And in this way, once we really feel this inside, we can surrender all of everything in this moment. And this is the out-breath. So it becomes a surrender on the in-breath and a surrender on this out-breath. The pauses in between. So this is the connectivity that is actually common in many different breaths. And the pauses mean that there's a little hesitation or a fear of either of the ones before. So the embrace that's leaning into life and stepping out into it, and the out-breath of just accepting all that is, landing into it. So we train this breath, we train the inner to trust and surrender to all that is. And then when we begin to do this, these little bubbles that are caught, the way I describe it is like a glass of lemonade or something, and they're trapped on the side. Mm-hmm. And we're just slowly wobbling it, maybe giving it a little tap. And these unresolved bubbles come to the surface and pop. And in this moment, what happens is that we begin to feel, or we begin to release energetically what it is that's in there. And in this breath, we see it all the time. People sometimes go into deep anger. Some people go into fear, shaking like this, the shake that comes out because it's caught in this way in the muscles.
Yes.
It can come in as tetany. You see this, and people know this. It's not tetany, actually. It's a tetany-like reaction.
Oh.
There is a science to it, but actually how we see it and how we feel it on a metaphysical level is that this is the physical manifestation of fear leaving the body, as is shaking and vibrating, because this is the nature of fear, is to hold in your muscles. When you're scared, your muscles clench and you use your breath and you gasp in to hold, because in this moment, an expression of it might be a scream, but if there's a predator coming from you, you don't want to be screaming because that'll alert them to where you are. So there's you get the release of adrenaline, you get everything that you need, and then where does this energy go? You need to pause for a moment, and in it goes, and it's held in you as a bubble until you come and do something like this, some emotional release. And little by little, this helps it come to the surface, to come out. This is what we facilitate within the breath work.
And so I'm sure then over your period of time, you must have seen all sorts of things manifest when people do this breath work. And you're saying there's some anger and some other... When somebody gets into one of those states and they're releasing whatever it is they're releasing, what do you do to support them through that? Mm.
And this is where the art of it comes in. And one of the things that we don't do when we're in order to hold them, we use our breath to stop ourselves from feeling and expressing and allowing this emotion. So what we want to do is we want to allow this trapped emotion to express itself. My philosophy is that the emotions are exactly there to help us. All emotions are great. Anger, the alchemy of anger, the positive expression of anger, can be to create boundaries, to be your no. No. This is the line, no. Mm. That's what the anger, positive expression. For grief, it's about letting go of one chapter and allowing another in. It's bringing in and welcoming in the new. With shame, it's really about creating a strong moral structure that will become part of your set of values and your belief systems. And this is where it becomes. So we do something that we feel is wrong, and then we use our shame to remind us to be there for that energy to change our habits so we don't do it again. Mm. And fear is there, obviously, to get us safe, you know, whatever it is. So We want it to come to the surface, to come out. So it's facilitating that. But in order to do that, sometimes breathing will be the thing that will help. And so sometimes just relaxing, getting people to relax into it and soften to let it flow. But then sometimes when it's flowing, it can be holding space. Now, holding space is really not interfering. It's making sure someone is safe and feels safe in order for it to unfold naturally in the way it always meant to, so that they're no longer carrying it. There can be some interfering, but generally it's more about getting obstacles out of the way to clear the path in order so it can be as free and a complete a release as possible in this way. And yes, we see all sorts of things. Some I've seen processes last more than 3 hours. I've been part of a process that took 10 breaths to start and took more than 3 hours to complete the cycle of the release. And it was a phenomenal thing to watch and a phenomenal change after, when you see people's whole personalities change, their whole lives change as a result. It can be a really, really just awe-inspiring thing to behold when you see the healing happen in such a tangible way when people's lives change.
Wow. What a job you've got. You know, most people go into the office and, you know, play about with spreadsheets and, you know, and get some satisfaction from some bits. I'm talking from experience here myself as well. But to, you know, to be part of something like that, I mean, I've been involved in breathwork groups where I've seen some of these things happen, but I've never led them. I've seen, you know, I've been part of them as if they've occurred. So I was going to ask, actually, I think you probably answered now, but so some of these releases, these big emotional releases, because I've seen them last half an hour or something like that, but they can go on for hours then, can they? And you're, the role of the sitter is just to kind of hold that space, look after them, let them feel safe, and just let them kind of get through it.
Yes, mainly I think so. There are nuances to it, of course. You know, if it's a fear release, then there might be there are other things you can do. So sometimes we would use words or something. If somebody is having a fear release, then just telling them that they're safe and they're held and we've got them might be a useful thing to do. Or if it's a deep shame thing that happens when people curl up, you see people go inwards and they curl up, they're hiding. They don't even want to be visible. In this, you're reading the body language and you're listening to the breath. The breath has a language of its own. When I do this in the dark, I can't see or ask people are in deep process, and I can still guide it just by hearing the sound of the breath. And there are different things, so that it is an art, but really actually mostly what people need is company and to feel safe. So just the safety of somebody being there, knowing that they're held, can be enough.
Yes. Actually. Okay. And when you, so if you were to start a session and you get some people together, what sort of things do you tell them is likely to happen through the session? How do you kind of mentally prepare people for something like this?
So, I mean, there are a few different things I go through. So I go through some practicalities. And I talk about all of the different barriers that can happen. Leonard Orr would call them urgency barriers, and the different things that will happen as the releases begin. And we see lots of different ones. So tetany is one, making sure people recognize it and don't get become in fear from it. Paralyzed by fear also. Quite often we get people who feel like they dissociate from their body, they can no longer feel their body and that they are stuck in a still place. When you are deeply in fear, the thing you need to do is paradoxical. You need to be able to feel safe in order to feel fear. The two don't go hand in hand so well, but in order to feel safe in your paralysis, to just allow the process and go through it, is another thing that I would talk to people about in advance. Falling asleep is a big one. So it's actually quite funny. People can come alert, awake, ready for it, not a drip of tiredness in them. And then they begin to fall asleep. And so when I'm with them, I'll start to say, keep breathing. And then if that's not working, I'll put a hand on the shoulder, on the leg, because this is a deeper, don't forget to keep breathing because they'll fall asleep. And if not, they come into semi-supine, so the knees come up. And then if they're still falling asleep, they'll sit up. And then some people will still be falling asleep. Sometimes you'll wake them up, they'll breathe two breaths, and they'll be asleep again. So you get them to stand up.
Wow.
And some people will still carry on falling asleep, stood up. So sometimes we open the window, we lean them. It's definitely more difficult to do in the dark. And we have to use other tools. So it's important that people know about the urgency barriers. There's a certain amount of trying not to create expectation, but for them to know that there's nothing new going to happen. It's all energy that they don't need to know, to just stay with the meditation of the breath, stay with the breath, an energetic breath. Key to this practice is that by being aware that you're breathing not just oxygen, but energy, prana, all of the different things that are coming in, it changes the focus of it. To keep people in the meditation of what they're doing, which is a focus on the in-breath as much as possible, and to keep them out of thinking too much about it, surrendering into it. Keep surrendering on the in-breath and the out-breath, in-breath and the out-breath. Keep going deeper and deeper into surrender, really, and leaning forward into it. There are a few things that can come up, and we guide them when it happens in the moment. But really, just trying not to create expectation is a good place to start.
Wow. Okay. And so it's the inhale in and exhale out, and it's a release with both. But do you encourage a pause in between, or is it a continuous breath?
It's continuous. It's distinctly continuous all the way. I do encourage a deeper breath. We encourage people to breathe more than they would do normally in a natural way. There's a grace to the breath. We're not forcing it, but it's like the embrace is, okay, let's try and do something different. Your breath is as it is because it's limited and it's shaped by your experience. So let's try and create this connected, continuous breath with intentionality is huge in this, always huge in this. And this is where the focus and the meditation of it really becomes something that holds a space for all of these things to come out. This intentionality makes it ceremonial. In fact, this comes back to shamanism and ceremony, really, is the difference between, for instance, doing recreational LSD or going to an ayahuasca ceremony. Something like that would be that there's two main things, there's lots of things, but intentionality really is one thing. Coming with the idea that what you're doing could make your life better. And the other thing is that it's in a non-social space. So it's coming into a space which is really just your own journey and being able to absorb and dissolve into this. And I've lost track of your question.
No, that's fine. It's more about the continuous breath and the gap in between. And that, no, I think you've answered that really well. What I want to really get stuck into now is the dark. Because this bit, for some reason, it terrifies me. When we first spoke about it, I don't know. So, and I think I did say to you on the phone before we had the meeting a few months ago, it was, I probably need to go towards that. But there's just something terrifying for me about being in the dark for a significant period of time. So can you just share with us what you do with the dark? Because it'd be great just to explain in your words.
Okay, so the dark is a shamanic medium. This is what it is, as is the breath, as is movement. We're doing something to create an altered state where we can connect more deeply to what is beyond or what isn't really our conscious mind and wherever that is. So when we're doing shamanic drumming, we go at about 4 beats per second. or something like this, which mimics maybe a little bit faster, which is the speed of the brainwave when we're in a meditation or in a hypnagogic hypnopompic state, which is this pre-sleep and post-sleep state where we're really open, where we lucid dream, and quite often people get really creative and their ideas are there. It's a really powerful state. It's the shamanic state, really, that we would drop into as shaman in order to connect, in order to connect to our intuition, into the guidance from these beings, in order to connect to something beyond our conscious mind. So the darkness, when it has many facets to it, it changes the brain chemistry in some fundamental ways. It inhibits serotonin release, and it increases melatonin release. Melatonin and serotonin are different. It's actually light that stimulates serotonin, but it's known as the happy hormone. Mm. And melatonin is known as the sleep hormone. So one of the things that happens is we go into a deep kind of sleepy, dreamy state, a little bit like the hypnagogic and hypnopompic states either side of sleep. Quite often people sleep a lot to begin with. It brings this about. Mm-hmm. It takes us into our shadow in some way, because it's taking away this kind of happiness to it. And we're going into, you know, this shadow darkness of ourselves. So it can mm-hmm. take us, connect us more deeply into what's hidden within us as well. The other thing that starts to happen, because melatonin and DMT are related, so this is another way in which to access this state of mind, dimethyltryptamine, which is this drug which has been synthesized and isolated, and people smoke it, or it's also contained in ayahuasca and is naturally occurring in the body. In fact, it's naturally occurring in all sorts of different things, most green things. Actually, it's inactive in our bodies thanks to a stomach and liver enzyme called monoamine oxidase. So broccoli has more DMT in it than ayahuasca, for instance, wow. which is per gram. Yeah. but it's inactive when we eat it because we have this stomach enzyme. The reason ayahuasca works is that it has this inhibitor that inhibits that enzyme so that it works in a different way. Another way we can access that is through different ways. So the darkness brings about this DMT because of the melatonin mm. and it naturally releases it. But also the breath releases DMT as well. We know this about the breath and the two things together. And so they're perfect bed partners, these two, in order to create an altered state. So after 3 or 4 days, people do begin, not in the same way as if you had taken some like psychedelic drugs or something, in a different way, in a more subtle way, but in a distinct way, you begin to become more visionary. Mm. So this dreamy aspect mixed with all of everything else really enhances it. It really takes us deep inside. I would say that in the darkness, we're blinded by the brightness of our internal essence. Everything becomes loud, our internal voice becomes loud, our personality, there's no escape from it, really. You can't distract yourself by going for a walk or yes. It's the perfect deep meditation. So everything that comes up is getting processed in a different way. Mm. And then we add the breath into it. So when we go in, we go in for... In the retreats that I do, we will meet, say, on a Monday. It varies a little bit, but it's a week long, and we come out on a Sunday. Wow. And there's a bit of integration time. But in the middle time, there's about 5.5 days, 130 hours, without one speck of light.
Wow.
Nothing at all. So you would eat, you would toilet, you would ablute, shower, bathe, all of it in the dark. And it becomes more disorientating, but then we would meet, we do different things together, some movement, some work with dreams, but really the focus is on breath to teach this technique. And for many people, one session can be very deep, but actually in the rebirthing tradition, it can take a while to overcome the body's natural urgency barriers, as Leonard Orr would call it, which cause you to fall asleep, to get a grip so you can learn it well enough so you can rebirth yourself. You can do the breath work for yourself and be able to stay conscious in amongst this emotional releases. So what I'm trying to do in the darkness retreat is teach people well enough so they can take this technique away and do it for themselves, which is rarely possible after 1, 2, 3 sessions. Generally, the minimum I see it takes people to get it is 6, 7 sessions, but really more like 8, 9, 10 sessions.
And is that, when you say session, is that of the 5 days, 130 hours?
And that's, they do that in the first 3.5 days. So we're doing about 3 sessions a day.
Right. Okay. Gotcha.
In amongst it. And then the last 2 days of the 5.5 days, we go into water. So this is the water rebirthing, because people go into, as I say, in fetal position, into warm water with a mask on. And with the mask that we use, you can breathe through the nose or mouth. You can forget it's there. It's a face mask. Mm-hmm. So you can really just relax into it and go into it. If people can do that, with a snorkel coming out underneath, over the water.
Yes.
And it's one-to-one at this point, because people are, I can't coach people because people can't hear me when they're submerged. So they are just using the technique that they've learned, and everything mimics the womb. But even more so in this way, because you've got the darkness and you've got the additional DMT. So DMT is released in large amounts at birth and at death. So part of the memory of our birth involves this dimethyltryptamine. It helps us to create neural pathways. It's food for the brain, these neurochemicals. And so that's one of the reasons purported why we release it at large amounts at birth. And so everything mingles together so that we're going in when we're releasing these bubbles, the ones that are trapped below our verbal memory before we've learnt, when we're connected completely to source, to whatever it is that's the womb and whatever it's before that, whatever your belief systems are. But before we've really able to coordinate or know what this world is, some things are more difficult to access then. Mm. So for instance, my need to create safety for other people, I discovered in breath, was because I was turned in the womb. I had a very strong experience of being turned in the womb. I didn't know what it was, but I felt it really strongly. And then I asked my mum, I didn't know about my birth, and I'd been breech, and she had turned me upside down in the womb, or someone else had. And so for me in my life, I'm in the safest place ever, growing. I had no worries in the world. All I have to do is grow. And then out of nowhere, this hand comes. And the energetic memory of that is trapped in me. And so in life, I don't know where this hand's coming from. I have no idea. Where's it going to come? And this white beard and all of everything, this is the fear. This is the kidneys and the fear that's trapped in with me from that experience. And we know it was really big because my mum went into contracting. She was having 2 contractions a day for the last 2 months. And then I was late by 2 weeks as well. So it went on. But she wasn't having them before the breech was turned. So it affected me in a really big way. And I came out carrying this energy. And with this work, I was able to go into this and to be able to connect to and understand and begin to work with this energy that was in my past. So going into some magic things happen. We had somebody I was studying this with. I learned with a woman, amazing woman called Fanny Van Leer, and someone in our class, amazing story, remembered a conversation, an argument her parents had whilst she was in the womb. She heard it again, but because she couldn't hear it when she was in the, she couldn't understand the words because she didn't know English when she was in the womb. She didn't know what it meant. She could feel the energy of it. It stuck with her enough that she could remember it. And when she re-experienced it in this way, she could hear the words exactly as it is. She heard it. Because she understood it, she was able to go to her parents and say, I had this experience. I don't know if it's true. This is how the argument went. And she recalled it. And her mum totally remembered it. It was really big for her as well.
Wow.
It was verbatim.
Yeah.
And that was stored in there. What an amazing story to have that, to be able to re-access to go back to the memories that happened to us in the womb.
In the womb, crazy. I listened to a podcast years ago now, a Joe Rogan podcast, probably 5 or 6 years ago, where he had a chap on who ran float labs or float...
flotation tanks.
Yes, flotation tanks, thank you. He would go in and do these big, long floats where he'd be in there for 8, 9, 10 hours. He'd go in there at night, basically. And I remember him telling the story that he went to his... This was a chap in his 40s or 50s. And he went to his mum and goes, I can remember sleeping on you and you had this dress on with this kind of check pattern. And she's like, you were like 6 months old or something. I can't remember what the age was now. She goes, how do you remember that? Because I don't know, it just came to me. Because I think what he's done is he's been in the flotation tanks for so long, he's been able to go back through and release memories, which I would never be able to get to because I'm constantly busy all the time. So that's really interesting, because I guess that just goes another step further, that all those memories are hit somewhere, and using a technique like what you've just described, you're able to get in there and get at them. That's fascinating. Wow.
It's incredible. The power of the breath is amazing. And for many, so simple, the darkness, you can get to by turning off all the lights, and the breath, we're always doing it and knowing the techniques. And it's such a beautiful, simple thing.
Yes.
That it's so easy to fall in love with these techniques, when you feel so different from them.
Yeah. I'm curious, have you ever taken a blind person through one of these dark experiences?
I haven't, but we did in the darkness. We had a one day in the dark where people came for dinner in the dark. And so everybody got the opportunity to see what it would be like to eat, not know what you're eating. And
yes.
The other senses expand. And we had a blind person come to that. In fact, in London, you might have heard of it, they've got a restaurant called Don Le Noir, where they have blind waiters in there that people experiment. But I've never. We did have someone. She was really happy. It was her birthday when she came, and she said it was one of the nicest experiences of her life because she felt like everybody was with her.
Yeah.
That's nice. Really lovely.
Yeah. I'm just curious because I know that even when people are blind, I think my understanding is you've still got the light receptors still function, I think, for a majority of people. So I wonder if there would still be something going on there if that person was in the dark for a significant period of time. I guess there'd be something going on there because they're not being stimulated. I heard this thing a little while ago where they do these sleep studies and the person's in pitch blackness and they shine a laser pen onto their toe and it wakes them up, I think, every time. Yeah. I heard them say. So it just shows that a whole body's receptive to light beams. Yeah.
In my studies of the dark and going into different people's dark retreats, I have been in where they use masks. And for me, I'm fidget and I want to scratch my eyes. There's no masks that suit me, especially really longer periods of time. And a little bit of light would come in each time I did it, which would affect. It feels like a totally different experience going somewhere where you have to wear masks. But this is also true, is that you're out and about and your body knows that it's light outside and it reacts in a totally different way. And for me, the places where I've been where you're actually in the darkness are totally different. The experience, the immersiveness that you get and the ability to sink into it. And also the emptiness, the void. And some people would say, this dark matter is anything but, and the empty space in space is anything but empty. And in some of the spiritual traditions around the world, some of them think it's sacrilegious to light up the darkness. They see it as important to be in pitch black as it is to receive sunlight in this way, to be in that pitch black, that it's nourishing in a different way. The Kogi are an amazing group, famous as one of the tribes that escaped Cortez and the Spanish Bible bashers that went over and took over all of South America, but the Kogi were so far away that they didn't get to them, so their culture is left intact. Mm. And some of their young will spend up to 19 years in the darkness.
Wow.
To become the seers. They're picked out at a very young age to go into the darkness, and they spend pretty much all of their childhood, what we would call childhood, up to 18, 19, and then they emerge. And because they're so connected in this way to the internal vision that they have, they are the guides for the community, and they hold a very special place.
Wow. God, I can't even imagine what that must be like. I guess they know nothing different, but wow.
Different.
I want to ask a bit, just because it's in my head. It's like, how do you, because the thing I'd be worried about, if I was in the dark with a mask on underwater, I'd be worried that I'd fall asleep and water would get in and I would drown. How can you stay safe during something like that?
It's one-to-one. So I'm always there. It becomes not a group session anymore. So obviously we've never had a problem yet. I've never had to pull anybody out but I can hear in the same way as I can hear the breath when we're doing the group sessions together. I've done many, many sessions in this way. And if somebody falls asleep, then their breath changes. And I can still touch and wake people up, or I would be able to pull people out. But actually, so far, nobody has ever stopped breathing or entered into such an altered state that it's become a danger or... So nothing's happened. Nothing's happened yet.
That's
but
good.
I'm there, one to one, listening
I hadn't thought about that, but yeah, you're right. If you've got a snorkel on, you're going to hear the breath, aren't you? Quite and if you're in a one on one. I clearly, as you can probably tell, I have a fear of drowning, and I really struggle with breath holds. I get a real panic really quickly, and I think it's because I've had some problems with swimming as a kid, and that fear of so yeah, I'm probably just, you're just getting my manifestation of oh God, what would it be like being in dark underwater as well? It's probably one of my greatest fears, actually.
We've had, funnily enough, I do lots of different types of retreats and work in shamanic ways that I would say would be, you know, also quite, it's normal for people to get nervous coming to it because it's a strong process. I work with strong processes.
Yes.
But the one that people seem to, something about the darkness and the breath, people are more afraid of the dark, even though there's absolutely nothing to be afraid of. The irrational fear is more present with that than with any other retreats that I do. And I have more people who really, really are intrigued and want to come and then never do than any of my other retreats. It's an interesting thing. But then all of the people who've come who have had, some people have had real fears of all sorts of different things, of being submersed in water, of suffocation, of the dark. All of them are really surprised at, because of the way it's done, because of the way we hold the space, that people are like, wow, I just felt actually really at home in the dark. It was a really pleasant place to be. And this, I think, can be a little bit like the memory of the womb as well, where it can be this perfectly safe space where a private, you're just with yourself and you've got everything that you need. You don't have to worry and you can go inwards. And it's surprisingly, I've seen experiments where people freak out in the dark, but I've seen people disorientated and have things come up. Lots of people have things come up for them in the dark, but it's not the dark that is ever the trigger of the fear of the dark never comes up. It's just whatever is there brought up by the shamanic medium, which is the dark.
Yeah, because it's really, because as you were saying that, I was thinking, I have that. I wouldn't say I'm scared of the dark, and I'll walk around the house and check the doors and stuff. And there's obviously a little bit of light, but yeah, the idea of being in a dark space for a significant period of time, it makes me a bit sweaty and a bit nervous. And I'm wondering, is that just because we don't do that? Like it's like. we're always surrounded by light, aren't we? Even now, you know, whatever time it is, it's late at night, it's winter, it's dark outside, but we've all got lights on our houses, and we've naturally or unnaturally disrupted the light balance in our lives. I'm wondering if we're just so scared because we just don't do it anymore. Any thoughts why you think people are so scared of the dark?
I think there is that element to it, really, is that it's... You know, we really naturally live in a cycle, a cyclical thing where it's natural to sleep more in the winter and to go inwards and in a different way. And we're separated from this. You know, there is no, we choose night and day now suddenly. But the darkness is the unknown. And fear and the unknown are linked, you know, intrinsically, actually. I think that's really where it comes from, that we don't know what's there.
Yes.
Our mind, this idea of knowing, is the mind, and the mind really manages our fears. You can see when people are really scared people, myself included, I'm quite a heady person, though. Grew up, you know, a thinker, a philosopher, a knower, a researcher, all of these things. And it's because of this hand that came out of nowhere, you know, partly, you know, because by understanding it, then I can make sure that I'm safe. And often the most scared people ask the most questions when they're coming. And I can see this happening. And quite often, if people keep asking questions, I will bypass and try not to answer too many questions and just try and guide people into something beyond that, that it's okay, you're safe, you can just trust and come. And it's a friendly mystery. It's a friendly mystery. You're okay.
Nice. You've put me at ease a little bit there by saying it like that. I quite like that. You've intrigued me a bit more. have you ever read anything about any of the miners that get stuck down in mines for like 10, 20 days? Because I'd be really interested to know if now, actually, you've said all this, if they've experienced anything being in, you know, utter darkness underground for significant periods of time.
People getting buried alive and all sorts of different things. And people, but it's one thing to choose it, you know, as a monk or all of the religious religions around the world that will go in and do it very deliberately. They say one man's prison is another man's ashram. And I think I think people do have the near-death experiences where people come to terms with, and that's part of what the darkness can bring as well, is that, you know, that the curtains draw at the end of our life and there's nothing there. So I haven't actually, the answer to your question is no, but I can relate to the people who have for some reason been into these near-death experiences and gone within, all of the different ways in which they have trapped, facing the bleakness, facing the nothingness.
Yeah.
It can be a really beautiful eye-opening experience.
And I guess I'm keen to know a bit about you now. What do your routines look like? And I guess, you know, you're human, so you must feel anxieties and stresses and depressions, I'm assuming. Or have you got to a point where you're able to kind of really cope with that sort of stuff now?
I think I cope well. In my early 20s, I think one of the things that really kicked off, I did some self-help seminars, but out of one of those self-help seminars, which actually looking back now and looking at the way they do things, I don't recommend actually to anybody at all, but it helped me. And I went into working with meditation. And funnily enough, the meditation, the Vipassana meditation, which I do once a year, I've done for 20 years now, and have it as part of my practice, has an element of it, which is the breath. So Anapana meditation was the type of breath work for the concentration that Buddha taught. And this is another way, it's concentration on the breath as it is, not as you would like it to be. As opposed to pranayama, this other way of doing things, which is the control of the breath, and all, I'm sure lots of the people watching this will be aware of pranayama, but this anapana technique really works very well alongside, and I've learned a lot from this technique with my breath as well. It's the other really main breath techniques that I work with. So I have meditation, and as with all meditation, it comes and goes. Even though I do it once a year, I go into it and I spend some time disciplined, but I move around quite a lot as well. So my discipline comes and goes. I have all sorts of different practices. So I tend to use the breath medicinally quite a lot. So I will use it as a technique when, if I'm feeling a buildup of energy, like there's some charge, we would call it in some of the shadow work that I do, we'd call it a charge that builds up for some reason. I'm not allowing myself to feel or express it, or it's built up for some reason. I have to be equanimous for the work that I'm doing, and it builds up, and then I will use it as a release. And I have a few different practices that I use, and breath is just one of them. So there are some people who are more dedicated into the rebirthing, who the part of that technique is bathing twice a day, doing breath every day. And I've spent time doing it every day, morning and evening. When I was really first into it, I went deep into it. And I tend to, with my daily practice, I tend to work with it within a meditation. So this anapana or vipassana meditation, which is just observation of the breath. And by observing it, allowing it to be as it wants to be in its natural way, actually releases. In Buddhism, they call them sankharas that come to the surface. So any trapped little things, quite a lot of it is surface stuff that's happened recently. Right. Quite a lot of the other stuff I've got up and got out. And then I also have my shadows. I talk about this in life, you know, there are some things when we're working with other people that this these techniques can, there are stuff that is resolvable that will come to the surface. We understand them, we release them, we integrate them more. The integration is the release, really. We're released from the power they have over us by integrating them, by loving them, by embracing these aspects of ourselves. And there are other things that are so deep in us, like my tendency towards fear, for instance, is so deep in my subconscious that it's more a process of accepting that as my makeup and mitigating the effects it has on my perceptions than it is ever overcoming it. And there's a long gradient scale. There are things that I accept and I recognize and I understand, and so they don't really have so much power in my life. And there are other things that I've totally dealt with and they don't even show up for me anymore. But I'm always working. I'm continuously working on myself in all sorts of different ways. So I have a few different things I do during my year that are deeper, in-depth practices, working with all of the medicines that I work with myself throughout the year, including darkness. And I work with North American Indian, doing sun dances and fasts and different practices. And as a daily routine, my meditation on good days, and that's about it, really.
Wow. Okay. So you're a busy person with a lot of different modalities going on there. So it's really interesting. The sun dancing, I think we're going to have to get into that maybe on another podcast. That sounds very interesting. Yeah. I've got one last question for you. Before I do, can you just, where can people find you? Where's, if you want people to come find out more about you and what you do and get involved in retreats and all that sort of stuff.
Great. So I announce a lot of my stuff through newsletters, but it's possible to get onto that. I have a website, which is sacredtree.co, without the .uk, just sacredtree.co, which has all of the work that I do with Cambo, which is one of the medicines I work with, and darkness. And it also has a little bit about the work I do with one-to-one. So I do some kind of coaching, helping people find their soul purpose, helping people with addictions, helping people with all sorts of health issues, from all sorts of pretty much anything. I will help people find their route to it, even if it involves getting other people involved as well. And the teaching that I do, so I teach some of this, I teach shamanic healing, I teach creating and holding sacred ceremonial space, and I teach Kambo practice. I teach a few different things, and all of that is on my website. And then my events throughout the year get announced through the newsletter generally.
Okay, wonderful. I'll put the links in the descriptions below so the guys can find that for you. So a bit, again, last question. This is one that answer however you would like, but if somebody comes up to you and says, what should I do to be better or to feel better? And you can answer it in a spiritual way or a physical way or both. What advice would you give a person on the street? If I just came up to you now and said, Greg, what can I do to feel better as a person or as a human?
For me, the thing that I keep gravitating towards, and this has moved in my life, but really, actually, I think fundamentally at the core of it, the place to aim for is understanding yourself well enough to know what your soul purpose is. Because when you are creating the world in which you would have liked to have grown up into and which you would like to see around you, when you're part and parcel in service beyond your own needs to other people, then you will feel fulfilled. When you are excited and fulfilled in life, abundance will come to you and you will have everything that you need because you're already fulfilled and everything else is a bonus. And from that root, the stress will go in the body, the inflammation will go with the stress, all of the physical, all of the emotional, all of the spiritual, all of the intellectual things will fall into place. That really is at the root of all of it for me, is to understand yourself well enough to know the reason you are here, the reason that you've gone through all of your pain and all of your joy, and the way to become the perfect expression of the divine being you are and you were born to be.
Fantastic, beautiful, thank you. So yeah, get to know yourself. It's just a very quick deviation. Have you heard of the author Robin Sharma?
No.
Okay, so he's. I've just read two. Well, I've read one of his books. I'm through the other one now, and the first one is called The 5 AM Club, which doesn't sound very spiritual, but it actually is. The second one is called The Monk Who Sold His Ferrari, and it's about a stressed out lawyer that has a heart attack at 50, and he goes in search of these sages in the Himalayas. And he has the essence of both books. It's funny what you just said. I might be butchering what he might be watching. Go no, but the essence of the books, from what I've read, is understand who you are and understand how you fit in and what you need to do to kind of find your purpose here in life. And it was just lovely to hear you say that as well. So that's lovely. So Greg, any last bits you wanted to cover off before we wrap?
I'm not sure really. Breath is a beautiful and awesome way to be connected. In the presence of the breath, we're alive. If we're simply with each breath, then we're alive. And each breath is such a beautiful gift. Each breath is one more moment in manifest in this beautiful world that we're in. And I'm so grateful for each and every breath. Yeah. And thank you for this time and these questions and your service to breath and all of this work.
No, thank you. I've really enjoyed it. And it's that there's a quote that always flies around my head, which is tomorrow's not promised. And I sometimes forget that and I get a bit stuck in the ego. And then other times I'm like, tomorrow isn't promised. All we've got is right now. And yeah, enjoy that breath, because it is, like you said, it's a gift, isn't it? To be able to take a lovely breath in and a lovely breath out. So Greg, thank you so much. I look forward to maybe doing another one of these in the near future. And guys, please check out Greg's links below. Get involved, get signed up. And thank you, everybody, for watching.
Cheers. Thank you, Mike. Thank you.
Cheers, Greg. Okay, thanks for watching Take a Deep Breath. Thanks for watching our breathcast. I hope you enjoyed the guest that we just had. Just a couple of quick messages. Thank you for sticking through to the end. Really appreciate it. If you enjoyed that and you haven't subscribed, please click that subscribe button and leave us a question or a comment, because it helps the Google algorithm. And it also means that we can interact and other people get involved and answer questions. So leave us a little question. That would be incredible. At the start, I mentioned our other YouTube channel, Hypnotherapy Unleashed. If you haven't gone over there yet, we've got a whole host of exercises in the world of hypnotherapy that can help you with addictions, anxiety, depression, and a whole other range of things that hypnotherapy can support with. So please go over there and you might find some real value over on that channel. And we're really trying to grow that community at the moment. So if you know somebody that could benefit from that and you wanted to share that, that would be really appreciated. On Instagram, you can follow me at takeadeepbreath.co.uk, and we've got regular content there. And finally, in the link below, we have a breath store. So what is that? So we have taken some of our top videos. I say we, it's me. I've taken some of our top videos and converted them into an MP3 format. And for just a couple of dollars, $4 or $5, you can go to this little store. You can go through PayPal or through your debit or credit cards, all secure, legit. And you can buy one of our MP3s. And that way you're supporting the channel. But not only that, you get to keep the MP3 forever. There's no ads. There's no anything else going on. So you can listen to it on your phone, on the aeroplane when there's no signal. And that's yours to keep forever. So yeah, that's down below. And that's our breath store, which has got, I think, 8 or 9 different breathing exercises on there. We're adding more as we go. And that's it. So yeah, so thank you so much from me. And we hope to see you on the next exercise or the next breathcast. And if you're finishing this right now and you're thinking, got a few minutes spare, not sure what to do, then try one of the breathing exercises. Box breathing is a lovely way just to help slow things down and relax us. You could do some alternate nostril breathing. Just go and have a look at the channel, look at the playlists and pick something for you. Give yourself a little treat. And we will see you on the next video. Thank you very much. Cheers.